From the beginning of time, the gap between what we preach and how we live has been rich ground for satirists. There's really nothing funnier than the privileged taking their privilege for granted while preaching egalitarianism to the world. But my guest today, Musa Oghabi, explores that ground for a bigger purpose, to explain the politics of America, the triumph of Trump, and the bewilderment of progressive, rich Americans that their country has come to this. Musa Oghabi is a sociologist and assistant professor in the School of Communication and Journalism at Stony Brook University in the US. His new book has a bold argument. It's called We Have Never Been Woke, The Cultural Contradictions of a New Elite. Musa, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
One day you saw a demonstration for Black Lives Matter. Tell us what happened.
So yeah, the book opens with a couple anecdotes about kind of events that got me thinking about the issues that the book explores. One of them was when I observed these protests that regularly happened after George Floyd's death. There were these protests in the Upper West Side of Manhattan on the medians of Broadway Boulevard, where people were holding up signs that said things like Black Lives Matter, calling for police reform and kind of condemning U.S. society and culture. One thing, there were a bunch of things that were striking about these demonstrations to me. The first is that the people who were taking part, you know, the Upper West Side of Manhattan is right above Harlem. So there's all sorts of Black people all around in that area, many of them doing service work for the professionals on the Upper West Side who go to schools like Columbia. But they weren't taking part in the protest. The people who were taking part in the protest were pretty much exclusively affluent white people. And another thing that was kind of striking, other than the demographics of the protesters relative to the demographics of the community, were that these protests were often taking place in a context where there were homeless Black people, like right in front of the protesters, sometimes sharing the median with the protesters. There were multiple times when I saw that the protesters were trying not to fall down as they were shaking their signs because they didn't want to step on the homeless people there with their stuff. Almost every single time when I observed this happening, the homeless people who were sharing the medians with these protesters were Black. And so this is a case where there was a Black person right in front of these protesters who needed help. And that person and those folks seemed to be invisible. If anything, again, they were an obstruction. And then another thing.
But can we just focus on that one for a moment? Because Musa, this is just an irony, isn't it? It's just an awful irony that there are homeless Black people. That's an issue. And there is a Black man who has been killed by the cops very, very publicly. This is a demonstration about police violence towards Blacks. Why does the presence of the homelessness in any way invalidate the protest about police violence? Why does the fact that the protesters are essentially all white and prosperous invalidate their concern about police violence?
So there are a few things that are important there. The first thing is that it is important, typically, if you want to help a population, to be deferent to what the people you're trying to help, what do they actually want? What do they actually need? What do they actually care about? And one of the reasons why you didn't see a lot of African Americans taking part in especially protest movements that were calling for, say, the abolition of police or, defunding, opening up all the prisons and letting the prisoners out and so on, is because African Americans, you can see when you look at nationally representative polling and survey data, and when you look at more local polling and survey data in New York, African Americans, especially less affluent African Americans and so on, while it's true that they often are disproportionately likely to suffer the excesses of the criminal justice system, they also are disproportionately likely to suffer from crime. They have real concerns often about public safety and public order that are already not being met. And so what you see in the polling and survey data is that a lot of African Americans have concerns about policing, but they don't want less policing. They want more and better policing, typically. And so it's important, on the one hand, to actually be advocating for the things that you want, that the people you're trying to help actually want, or else you can get in a situation where you produce something that is not what the people you're trying to help actually want, that actually makes their life worse.
But surely they also want not to be killed by cops.
Well, this is what I said, is they want more policing and less policing. But
that's what the demonstration was about.
No, but the protesters weren't calling for more policing and better policing. They were often calling for decarceration and things like closing the prisons. Closing the prisons For instance, here's a good example. According to a lot of symbolic capitalists, what we assume is that America's prisons are just overrun with large numbers of African Americans who committed small, petty, nonviolent crimes, and they just have these huge, immense sentences. And in fact, the overwhelming majority of people who are in prison in the United States are in prisons and jails for violent crimes, rapes, murders, assaults. Even the people who are there for drugs are there not for like having a small amount of drugs for their own personal use, but for trafficking drugs in ways that ravage communities and so on. And so one of the reasons why you see this gap between symbolic capitalists and ordinary Black people on issues like opening the prisons is because for people like us, opening the prisons, we're often, again, one, laboring under this false set of beliefs about who's in prison, and two, we don't have to pay the consequences of opening up the prisons because we often live in gated communities or houses with private security guards, and the people aren't going to be moving to our neighborhoods anyway. What less affluent and less white people hear when they hear close the prisons is take a bunch of rapists and murderers and drug dealers and put them in our communities. And they're right that those are the communities that they're going to go to, and they already have concerns about public safety. Their kids are already getting killed. Their communities are already being hollowed out. And so this is part of the reason why you see this gap.
But Musa, that is a particularly radical proposal, which is supported by almost nobody in the United States when you look at it carefully. And you are talking about that when I am asking you, do you support Black Lives Matters in this particular view the death of George Floyd? Well, do you think it's worth demonstrating, or are you saying that demonstrations are a waste of time?
Well, but this is what I mean. It's actually Black Lives Matter, the organization Black Lives Matter, is highly polarizing to Black people, both because they do call for things like decarceration and abolition. The Black Lives Matter, the organization Black Lives Matter, has endorsed these policies explicitly. And you have writers in the New York Times writing things like, when we say abolish the prisons, yes, we literally mean abolish the police.
Crazy.
But the people who are most likely to embrace these views, you can see this again in polling and survey, are highly educated, relatively affluent, urban and suburban white people, the kind of folks who were. And one of the things that's striking, actually, that to just bring the original question full circle, is that a lot of the folks who were taking part in this protest, the same constituency of people who were arguing for Black Lives Matter, also banded together to kind of purge Black people like that.
Get them out of their district.
From their community and district. We had a lot of, as I talk about there, we had a lot of
Are they the same people? Are they exactly the same people, or are just the same? Well, it is hard to know.
It's the same constituency. It's going to be it's going to be it's highly educated, relatively affluent, urban and suburban people who self-identify as liberal. You can see that pretty consistently.
This is Late Night Live. I'm David Mahan. I'm talking to Musa Alghabi about his book, which is a conundrum book in many ways. We Have Never Been Woke: The Cultural Contradictions of a New Elite. To read the title of the book casually might make it seem that you are accusing these left liberals of being woke, which is, you know, the traditional insult. You're going much further than that, and you're saying they aren't woke. They think they are, but they ain't.
Yeah, in the sense that, one of the big things the book wants to explore is how often these narratives that we tell about these kind of social justice-oriented narratives often help us justify inequalities and reinforce inequalities, and they don't do much to help the marginalized and the disadvantaged. I'll give you two quick examples. So first, that protest I was mentioning. So one of the things that that jumped out at me is that there's not actually a correspondence between what the people were doing and what it is they said they wanted to accomplish. Like, I couldn't tell a story in my own mind, even being maximally charitable, about how standing in the Broadway Boulevard and waving a sign and then having other people honk and you go, woo, while you're stepping over Black people. Like, I couldn't tell a story of how that would save even one person's life, get even one person out of prison. There didn't seem to be a correspondence between what they were doing and what they said they wanted to accomplish, in which case I was forced myself to reckon with the question of, like, what's going on here? Who is this actually for? It's not for the people in prison, because there's nothing that's happening there that's actually benefiting anyone in prison, right? And so who is it for? And so one of the things that the book does urge people to do is to pay attention to the correspondence or lack thereof between what we're doing and what we say we want to accomplish. The other thing is that often these social justice narratives can actually justify inequalities. So I'll give a quick example there. In a lot of symbolic capitalist spaces, there are these kind of narratives about white privilege that are really prominent. The idea behind white privilege, teaching people about white privilege, is that in virtue of people's race and ethnicity, and especially how they're perceived and coded by others, some people don't have to face the same challenges as others. Some people have kind of unearned advantages on the basis of their race and ethnicity. There's a lot of empirical research to substantiate that broad claim. The thing, though, is like the idea behind teaching people about white privilege is that, one, there's this narrative that all white people have the same privilege on the basis of their unearned advantages. And that's just not true. As I show this at the beginning of chapter 6. That's just not true with respect to any unearned advantage. How much you benefit from that privilege is really context dependent. And in fact, the kind of people like in symbolic capitalists actually tend to benefit much more from their race than less affluent white voters who live in other kinds of communities. But set that to the side. The idea behind the white privilege narrative is that if you sensitize people to these unearned advantages, that it will lead people to treat non-white people differently than they would, that it would lead them to maybe consider reallocating resources and opportunities to non-white people in a way that they wouldn't have
before. Be more thoughtful, show more empathy.
Yeah, things like this. Now, so there's been empirical research on what happens when you do this training in practice. What does it actually change? Does it change anything? And what the research seems to find consistently is that teaching people about white privilege doesn't actually change in any way how they think about non-white people. It doesn't change how they treat non-white people. It doesn't lead anyone to reallocate resources and opportunities to people who need help. The main effect of teaching people about white privilege is it causes them to look at poor white people and to think they must really deserve their poverty. You were born with all this privilege. You were born on third base. You can't crawl your way across the home plate. Well, you must really suck, right? And so this is a narrative that on its face is egalitarian, but in practice allows us to kind of point to the people who are losing and suffering and falling behind and to say they deserve their loss. They deserve their suffering.
So Musa, demonstrating isn't worth, demonstrating is a waste of time. Teaching people about white privilege is a waste of time. What about DEI? Right now, there have been, for the last, 20 or 30 years, there have been programs to encourage employers to employ people who are not necessarily white, Protestant, Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah. Well,
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Yes. So to speed it up, I guess. Yeah. So the point is that these programs were created to address real problems. Is the point. There were real dysfunctions, lawsuits when a lot of these institutions started integrating around sexual harassment, around discrimination, around cultural differences and things like this. A lot of chaos. So companies reached for this diversity training, which had been kind of piloted in small settings, but had never really been implemented and tested. And then, over the decades, it became clear that a lot of these organizations still had a lot of problems. So social scientists started to go, well, hey, does this stuff actually work? It turns out, for about 30 years now, there's been a pretty systemic empirical efforts to study the efficacy of DEI efforts. What the empirical literature shows over and over and over again is that these programs don't work. When you look at what their stated goals are, they don't achieve their stated goals, and often they're counterproductive. They're kept in place largely because even though they don't actually help people work across difference more, they don't help with retaining underrepresented people and so on, what they do effectively is they shield corporations from lawsuits and things like this.
Well, so are you just a conservative man? I don't mean that in any way as a criticism. A conservative man, highly skeptical of progressive ideas. For which you have written a very elegant sociological justification. But these policies are just not to your taste.
No, I mean, so one of the interesting things about the book is that, as readers will see as they read the book, is my thinking on these and a lot of issues were deeply informed by queer theory, for instance, by post-colonial theory, by critical race theory, by feminist standpoint epistemology. One of the big projects that I see the book doing, actually, is taking the arguments of those literatures to what I view as their logical conclusion, which would lead us to ask, to why would we think our own preferred ideologies are somehow exemptions to how ideologies work in general? If the argument from these literatures is that who comprises a field shapes the knowledge that's produced by the field, that ideologies are often used by the rich and powerful to advance their own interests without advancing the interests of the people that they say they're trying to help. If we think this is true of ideologies in general, why should our own ideologies be exempt? And so I'm adopting a reflexive approach. Yeah, one of the things that actually conservative and anti-woke reviewers of the book have not loved is that I'm a big fan of what I call symmetrical analysis. So if people are living in the same kinds of communities, taking part in the same kinds of professions, living the same kinds of lifestyles, but they think different things in their hearts, the fact that they think different things in their hearts is irrelevant to me for the purposes of analysis. So one of the things I stress over and over in the book is that there's
How can that be irrelevant? Surely that is fascinating. Well, they live in the same areas, same class, same sorts of families, but they have profoundly different views.
Well,
you can't just wipe that, can you?
Well, you can if what you're trying to understand is, like, why do social problems come about and persist? Who benefits from them and how? Then what people feel in their hearts and minds isn't really... In fact, I think one of the things I stress in the book is that if you look at symbolic capitalists, we are the Americans who are most likely to self-identify as anti-racist, as feminist, as environmentalist. Our institutions are most likely to have these DEI programs, for instance, and to make these DEI statements. They're also some of the most racially parochial institutions in the entire economy. They're some of the most hierarchical institutions in the entire economy. Our communities, like New York, is controlled by Democrats. Nearly exclusively, the city council, 11-1 Democrat or something like this. The state legislature, 2-1. The mayor is a Democrat. The governor is a Democrat. But New York has some of the highest levels of inequality, some of the highest levels of poverty, some of the highest levels of segregate, some of the most segregated school systems, some of the lowest levels of social mobility in the country. And the same thing is true.
And the next man to be mayor is going to be a young Muslim.
Well, we'll see, actually, because... you know, usually it's kind of pro forma. Whoever wins the Democratic nomination becomes the governor because it's overwhelmingly Democrat town. But this is going to be an interesting cycle for a bunch of reasons. So we'll see who the governor ends up being in the general election. But in any event, one thing that you see when you look at across the country, this is true. You can look at that some of the most liberal places are some of the places where things like poverty, immiseration, inequality, segregation, and so on are some of the most prominent. The issue in those places isn't that people don't think the right things in their hearts and minds, and that if only we went from like 9 out of 10 Democratic city council members to fully 10 out of 10, then we'd shift from being the most unequal, poor place in America to with huge concentrations of poverty despite immense concentrations of wealth to somehow being a socialist utopia. That there's that one Republican on the city council who's he's the big obstacle, right? Like the big problem isn't that, it's not that Democrats don't have enough power to actually achieve their goals. Because again, like in these communities where wealth is concentrated the most, Democrats control with basically one party rule. And then second, the issue isn't that they don't believe the right things in their hearts and their minds. It's that they don't translate into actions in a way that actually addresses the problems that they're trying. So
Is your book a message to the Democratic Party to pull its finger out and actually do a few things rather than just posing?
Well, in a way, like I do hope that Democratic, in a way, I hope that politicians and take lessons from the book. I didn't write it as a strategy guide or anything like that. But one of the things that it is important for Democratic Party leaders and supporters of the Democratic Party to definitely reckon with is that when you look at trends over the last 10 years, as I show in a lot of my work, including this essay I published after the 2024 election, it's called A Graveyard of Bad Election Narratives. What I show is that if you look over the last 10 years during this period of great awakening among people like us, what you see two things that are really interesting. One, you see rich, highly educated and white people increasingly shifting towards the Democrats. And then you see, on the other hand, working class, less educated, non-white people, religious people across Muslims, doesn't you name it, shifting towards the Republican Party. They're growing alienated by the Democrat, by our preferred political party, and are shifting to the right in a way that doesn't sit well with a lot of our narratives about what we're doing, what we're about, who we represent, and so on. You look at the electoral trends over the last several cycles, this is a thing that you see over and over and over again.
But don't we also have to acknowledge at the same time the superb political strategies of the Republican Party to win over the working classes of the United States of America, who are now being kicked in the guts by Trump's one big beautiful bill. I mean, this is political deception of the greatest skill.
I think people actually overestimate how much the trends that we're seeing have anything to do with Trump or with the political messaging of the Republican Party. It seems like it's driven mostly by alienation from the Democratic Party. And you can see this in part because the shifts actually predate Trump. So before Trump was had announced, 3 years before he was even a candidate, you see these same trends in the 2012 election. You see them in the midterms in 2014, again, before Trump had even announced and before the Republican candidate was...
Much too simple to blame Trump.
And so, yeah, so I think it's not about political messaging on the Republican side. I think it's not... I think it's more about the problem is their perception of Democrats, not that they think that they've been deceived into thinking the Republican Party is some kind of great vehicle to address their concerns. And the reason why the shift is happening is because a lot of less affluent, working class, less educated type voters, they voted for the Democrats. They typically tend to vote Democrat because they think that Democrats are better allies on things like government programs and redistribution, and on African Americans often voted for Democrats because they were viewed as better allies on civil rights and again, supporting government programs, things like this. But they typically disagree with Democrats on a lot of the cultural issues. They've never been, like if you look at immigration.
Hence the culture wars. That's why the Republicans fight the culture wars,
But one of the things that I show in my data is it's not actually the Republicans that are driving the culture wars. So if you look at the shifts in public opinion, if you look at the shifts in the respective party platforms and things like this, one of the things you see over and over again is actually a pretty decent consistency on the red line of charts. The Republicans aren't actually changing that much. Almost all the change that's happening is on the blue line of charts. Now, this has been largely invisible to scholars because almost all of us are on the blue line of charts. And to us, we don't think...
That looks natural.
So we can see this gap growing between us and other people. But we assume that the reason the gap is growing is because those people must be changing, that they must be growing more racist, more sexist, and so on. But what you can see in the data is that actually most of the rest of the public, whether you're talking about Republicans or moderates and independents, it doesn't matter. What you see in either case is that they're basically chugging along on the same trends that they've been on for decades on most of these issues. One of the things you see is that as symbolic capitalists started shifting, the Democratic Party platform, messaging, candidates started shifting to match us because we are a really valued constituency for the Democratic Party. We vote at higher rates. We contribute at higher rates. We take part. We're more likely to sign petitions and do canvassing and things like that. So they really care about us and our vote. So they shifted as we shifted in a way that put them increasingly out of touch with mainstream Americans. And not only did the gap grow bigger, but people cared about the gap more. And they cared about the gap more, largely because of how people like us conducted ourselves. So we became really militant about mocking, harassing, trying to censor and demean people who disagreed with us, even on views that we adopted 10 minutes ago. So like 10 minutes ago, we decided that we need not just police reform, but like radical, radical, radical change to society writ large. And if you disagree with me on that position, I'm going to call you a racist, even though I just adopted that position myself 10 minutes ago. So this kind of behavior causes people to notice the gap between us and them and to care about it more than they normally would. And this creates an opportunity for political entrepreneurs, usually associated with the right, to basically campaign on bringing people like us back under control. This is a pattern that repeats in each of these periods of awakening is that because of how we conduct ourselves, we basically give shovels to people who become our gravediggers.
Musa, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been talking to Musa Alghabi, sociologist, assistant professor in the School of Communication and Journalism at Stony Brook University, about his new book that bears very careful reading. The book is called We Have Never Been Woke: The Cultural Contradictions of a New Elite.